welcome to Comic Talk Today for Tuesday, December 4th, 2018. This is Top of the Pile, so I'll be talking about some of my favorite books from last week. And last week was a really weird week. I almost felt like I couldn't pick enough books to talk about on Top of the Pile. And I don't know if it was the fifth week. Maybe it was. Was it a fifth week? It had to be. But I did find five books that I definitely want to talk about. Two will be slightly controversial. So I'm going to do one to kick this off and one to end the episode. So I'm going to kick off with Image Comics, The Warning, number one, written and drawn by Edward LaRoche with colors by Brad Simpson, letters by James Reed. And this is quite an interesting book for the simple reason that the format of the issue is a little odd. I don't normally look at reviews for books that I talk about on this show until after I talk about them. But I read this one, and I really enjoyed it. And I was like, huh, I wonder what people think about this issue. So I went out and looked up a couple of reviews, and everyone was kind of, to be honest, kind of crapping on this book. I saw a lot of 2 out of 10, 3 out of 10s, and I didn't quite understand that. So I'm going to put a kind of warning, on my The Warning review, because I really enjoyed it. In fact, I'm going to get my rating out of the way and say it's going to be a 4 out of 5. And I think the reason for that is that the book is extremely intriguing. Now, the format of the book is weird because it is told, I think there's like 4 different vignettes, 4 different storylines going on. And they are all related. They are all very short. They all happen at different times. And I think part of the reason why people are having an issue with this particular book is, number one, there's a lot of military jargon. In particular, one of the first stories, there's a lot of like code names and Greek letters and numbers and this, that, and the other. So if you're not familiar with military jargon, I think this will be a little difficult to follow, at least, in that particular story. The other problem is that a lot of this book is very low on panels, we'll say. A lot of the pages are just like one panel, and I'm not even talking about like a full page panel. I'm talking about like a half panel with a black background on the rest of the page, or, you know, 2 or 3 panels. And because there's a lot of narration going on, and I say a lot of narration as in not enough speech bubbles, but the narration isn't really telling you a lot of what's happening. A lot of it is people's thoughts being put onto the page. So you have, you know, in a page you might have like 5 or 6 different word balloons, narration word balloons, but they don't really tell you what it is that you're seeing on the page. And so as a result, you don't really get to know what this book is about. And really, I'm going to be honest with you, at the end of the issue, you really don't know what the book is about. All you really know is, spoiler alert, that there is an alien invasion going on. But we don't really know how these stories connect to that alien invasion. And the only reason we know that there's an alien invasion is one of the stories takes place 4 months prior to the opening of this book. And we see a group of military scientists who have been following this like little grain of sand that's starting opening up this like quantum realm, quantum portal in the middle of nowhere. And so the military has been studying this thing. And after several months go by, they see that it's getting bigger and bigger, and there is like some kind of tractor beam being shot at this little grain of quantum elemental sand thing, and it's kind of attracting an alien planet into our Earth. And that planet has kind of escaped the gravitational pull of its own star, so it's no longer part of that. The only way that it can travel through space is through this tractor beam that it's pulling itself here. And I mean, that's really the core of the story, but were it not for that like one page story, you really wouldn't know that, because much of the centers around a couple of different strike teams around the world. And as a result, I think people were a little confused, but I gotta say, I really enjoyed it. And I think part of the reason I enjoyed it is it doesn't give you everything on the page. And I know a lot of comic fans like to know exactly what's happening in their comic books. And when you don't get that particular type of story, you get a little lost and confused and maybe end up rating the book quite a bit lower. So I think this book is going to be one of those things where it'll read extremely well in trade. In fact, I wouldn't be surprised if this was written to be published as a trade paperback. and Image decided to put it out as a miniseries instead. I would not be surprised at all. Had they done that, I think it would have made more sense. And what I would have liked to see, and again, I don't know if this is a 4, 5, 6 issue story, but what I'd like to see is kind of what Action Lab does with some of their books, and release this where you get like the first 2 or 3 issues in one book. And yeah, you pay a little bit more, but you get really the beginnings of the story. Because I don't think the story of the warning is really going to shine or really be made aware to the reader until at least the second issue. And that's going to be a problem for a lot of people. But for me, I really enjoyed it. I think that the journey of this book is more important than the plot itself. And as a result, I really, really enjoyed it. So the warning number 1 from Image Comics is going to be a 4 out of 5. Over to Marvel, let's talk about Ironheart number 1. This is written by Eve Ewing with art by Kevin LeBronda and Luciano Vecchio. We've got layouts by Gioffo and colors by Matt Miller, letters by Clayton Cowles. I think Clayton Cowles like letters everything now. Anyways, Ironheart number 1. So of course, Ironheart, a character I believe created by Bendis in the Iron Man series, a character that I did not really quite enjoy in that particular book. So I wanted to put it in here because I wanted to talk about it, because I didn't care for Ironheart before this book. I didn't. I thought it was kind of like a cheap knockoff, trying to bring in kind of a sidekick-y character to Iron Man, maybe a character that could eventually take the mantle of Iron Man if Tony Stark were to disappear, and I just wasn't really a fan. But having read this book, I was actually really very pleasantly surprised, and I think a lot of that has to do with the art style, not so much the story itself. The story is actually pretty straightforward, and I'm not terribly familiar with Eve Ewing, but I like the way that she managed to give Ironheart a lot of personality. And really, there is a lot that we learn about Ironheart in this book, both things that have happened in the past. So if you're familiar with Ironheart from the Iron Man series, you'll recognize some of the supporting cast, you'll recognize some of the technology. But I like that this is kind of a fresh new take. She's got a new costume, which I actually kind of like. It's definitely very different. It's like purple and yellow and pink. But I think it works for this character, because she's still kind of learning to be a hero. She's still kind of getting a lot of inspiration from Iron Man. In fact, one of the plot points of this book is her creating an AI to help her when she's fighting in the Ironheart costume. And, you know, she's in her lab, and the dean of the school goes in there with a bunch of, like, diplomats and government agents. And she's kind of like, why are these people here? Like, I need to know in advance, right? There's, like, weapons and advanced tech in this room that I have to secure. And when we see one of the weapons kind of start firing off as these people are there. And I thought that was interesting that it was handled. It's definitely, I don't think, a book written for the typical comic book demographic, and I think that's fine, because I think this is a book that I could read with my 15-year-old, for example. I think this is something she would enjoy. In fact, I'm going to have her take a look at this book and see what she thinks. But I really liked it. I really liked it. There's definitely a lot of, like, relationship issues with teens or young adults. So, again, something that's maybe not for me. But I like the aspect of her learning to be a hero and how she's going to evolve to become something more than what she is now. And I like that, right? When comic book companies introduce these kind of sidekick-type characters, oftentimes they don't give them enough room to breathe and become their own thing, right? They just become like a shadow of whatever their mentor is. And I think this book is really going to help Ironheart shine and come into her own. And I wouldn't mind seeing her join one of the bigger teams down the line, right? Even maybe the Avengers. Possibly the Avengers now, because that storyline is very convoluted and definitely would work better with more established characters. But so far, I'm really enjoying Ironheart number 1. I'm going to give it a 4 out of 5 as well. And I'll definitely be picking up the next issue. We'll see how long I end up actually sticking with this book. But for now, I'm curious, and I'll definitely be checking it out going forward. Over to DC Vertigo, and matter of fact, the rest of the books I'll be talking about are DC books, is Hexwives number 2. And I wanted to briefly talk about this book because I really enjoyed the first issue, and I found this second issue to be quite a bit different than the first, right? So in the first issue, we learn about this whole long history of witches, witch coven, fighting this group of witch hunters, right? And so all the witches are female, all the witch hunters are male, and at the end of the issue we learn about this plot that the witch hunters have to kind of hypnotize the witches into becoming kind of like Stepford wives, right? So that's what's called hex wives. And so they're living in this kind of like imaginary town where all the witches are married to the witch hunters. Obviously the witch hunters haven't told the witches that they're witches, and they all live a very like 50s lifestyle, right? Like the women wake up, they shower, put on their makeup, they start cooking, they clean the house, they get together with each other and chitter chatter, drink wine and bake cookies, and then their husbands get home, so they make them dinner and they please them in other ways sometimes. There was actually a funny interaction in this issue where the main witch, her husband tries to have sex with her. And you do see a couple panels of this. You don't really see any nudity. I mean, there's nudity, but no private parts, I guess. And as it turns out, once he's done, she's like, "But you never went in." And I thought that whole thing was pretty funny, right? He was so excited that he just kind of did his thing without actually having sex with her. So that was pretty funny. But there's some hints of weird stuff going on, right? And one of the plot points of the entire issue is that this woman is hearing scratching in the walls. And so she thinks that, maybe there's like mice in here. So she asks her husband to call the exterminator, and he's like, "Look, we had the exterminator here a couple months ago. I'm sure it's not mice. You don't like want to kill the mice, do you?" And as it turns out, she wakes up in the middle of the night one night and realizes there is a hidden room behind the bookshelf, and there is a naked, drugged witch behind this, and the witch calls out her name and says, "Finally, you found me." I thought that was interesting. So now we're gonna really see things kick up a notch, I think. And I believe this is a miniseries. Based on the way the story is progressing, I would think it would remain a miniseries. I don't know if there's enough for an ongoing once the main plot line wraps up, but you know, I guess it depends on how well this book is doing. But I really enjoyed it. The art is actually really, really brilliant. Ben Blacker's the writer. Mirka Andolfo is the artist. Beautiful book to look at. Again, I wished they would have spent less time on kind of expanding the Stepford Wives element of the whole thing. But I feel like maybe it was kind of necessary in order to get to that final reveal in the last page. And that's really going to change things up, I hope, for the next particular issue. So I'm really still enjoying this miniseries. I enjoyed the second issue a little bit less than the first, but it's still going to be a 4 out of 5. Over to DC proper, DC's Nuclear Winter Special. This is a vignette of different stories, I think 10 different stories. So we've got a Rip Hunter Time Master in Nuclear Winter Special. That's the main part of the story that kind of connects all these other vignettes throughout the issue. It's an 80-page book, so there's plenty to read here. I can't remember how much it was, like 6, 7 bucks, 8 bucks. But I thought it was kind of worth it. It wasn't really Christmassy. I mean, there were some stories that were definitely more Christmassy than others that actually take place during Christmas, right? So like the Batman 66 story, the Firestorm, what was the other one? The Green Arrow one was really set on Christmas, but some of the other ones not so much. They just happen to take place in this kind of future post-apocalyptic world, and all connected through this Rip Hunter story written by the one and only Mark Russell, with art by Mike Norton, colors by Hi-Fi, and letters by Darren Bennett. And the Rip Hunter story was interesting because Rip kind of shows up on Earth, and it's post-apocalypse, right? There's a nuclear winter, hence the title of the book. And he tries to – he's getting chased by these guys, right? These – it's kind of Mad Maxy, right? Like these guys want to grab him and cook him and eat him. And he kind of prevents that by telling them stories of heroes whom they are aware of from before the apocalypse. And that kind of prevents his own demise. And of course, a story that Mark Russell would be fantastic at, because I think Mark Russell is a freaking genius. We've got Aquaman, let's do it in order. Batman 666 in Warmth, written by Colin Kelly with art, or in Jackson Lansing, art by Giuseppe Camuncoli. Inks by Cam Smith, colors by Romulo Fajardo Jr., and letters by Clayton Cowles. We've got Superman 1 Million and Memory Earth. That's Steve Orlando writing, Brad Walker pencils, Drew Hennessy inks, Colors by Nathan Fairbairn, letters by Clayton Cowles, The Flash and Once in Future by Jeff Loveness with art by Christian Deuce, colors by Luis Guerrero and letters by Tom Napolitano, Supergirl and Last Daughters, so that's Tom Taylor with breakdown by Tom Derenick, art by Yasmin Putri and letters by Darren Bennett, Aquaman and Where the Light Cannot Reach by Mirgid Scott, art by Dexter Soy. I love some Dexter Soy art. Colors by Veronica Gandini. Letters by Steve Wands. Firestorm and Last Christmas. That's Paul Dini. Love me some Paul Dini. Jerry Ordway is the artist. Dave McKay is the colorist and Dave Sharp on letters. Commandi and Northern Lights by Phil Hester. Written in ink and pencils. Love me some Phil Hester. Andy Parks on inks. Trish Mulvihill on colors and Steve Wands on letters. Catwoman and Nine Lives, that's Cecile Castellucci by, is the writer. Amanke Nawalpan by, is the artist. Brian Buccellato is the colorist. And Josh Reed on letters. And then Green Arrow in The Birds of Christmas, Past, Present, and Future. That's, Dave Wilgas is the writer. Scott Collins on art. John Calise on letters. Tom Napolitano on letters. Or, John Calise on colors, excuse me. And Tom Napolitano on letters. So, out of all these, there's some really good ones, and I think this will definitely appeal to a wide audience. I really enjoyed the Firestorm story. That's Paul Dini with Jerry Ordway. Because it's Jerry Ordway art, it does feel a little more old school, we'll say. You know, 70s, 80s type art style, but it works really well. Firestorm having kind of like a mix Hanukkah, Christmas type dinner with robots that want to kill him. I thought that was a really interesting story, really well done. I really was partial to the Batman 666 story because I have a long history with Batman 666. Batman 666, of course, it's named that because he appeared in Batman issue number 666. It's a Grant Morrison kind of creation, I guess. And it's Damian Wayne in the future, and where he has become Batman. And I thought it was actually pretty interesting to read this, because in Batman issue 666, this Damian as Batman is not a very nice guy. He almost reminds me of the Flashpoint Batman, right? The Thomas Wayne Batman, where he's very angry. He does use guns and he kills a lot of people. Whereas in this particular story, he is kind of quite the opposite. He is fighting his grandfather, of course, Ra's al Ghul, during Christmas Day, and they have some interesting back and forth where, you know, Ra's is kind of like, hey, you know, I trained you to be the son of the demon, and, you know, you need to become that. Why are you not that? And Damien's kind of like, well, I was going to become that, but my father taught me a better lesson, and that lesson is not to kill. And that's kind of the lesson that he teaches Ra's, and as a result, they end up having a bonfire next to a Christmas tree, a pine tree. And I thought that was kind of heartwarming a little bit, and definitely different than what I remember seeing of Damian as Batman. So I look forward to seeing DC hopefully do some more Batman 666 stuff at some point in the future. I don't know how well that could be integrated into the Batman family proper, because it is Damian as an adult, and I'm talking at least 30 years in the future, I would say. But for me, it worked pretty well. And I like the costume design seemed a little different, right? So it was still kind of that, it's not a trench coat, but it almost looked like a Rocketeer type outfit, right? Except it's black and gray to symbolize the Batman colors. But then the cape is basically the skin of a giant bat. So it's kind of weird to see Damian kind of fight in this thing at some point, because you see like the bat, there were actual bat wings, you see the bat ears kind of form the piece that goes around the neck, but I thought overall it was kind of interesting to see. And you know, I love Ra's as a character, and I love Damian both as Batman and as Robin, so that was very cool for me to see. So really enjoyed that story. The Supergirl and Last Daughters I thought was really interesting. That's a Tom Taylor story. And the reason for that is it's not necessarily Christmassy, but it does have that kind of spirit of Christmas, and it definitely plays upon Supergirl's origin story quite a bit. Basically, after this apocalypse, Supergirl goes to find her daughter and save her from the apocalypse. And, you know, they need to get out of Earth because the Earth is dying. And so she finds, she goes to the Fortress of Solitude, Superman's Fortress of Solitude, uses the key to open it up, goes inside, finds a capsule where she and her daughter can escape. And originally she's gonna send her daughter on her own, right? Just like she was sent to Earth, and just like Kal-El was sent to Earth. But, her daughter's like, why can't you come with me? I don't wanna be without you. And Supergirl kinda has this whole inner monologue where she's like, you know what? She's right. You know, when I came here, I was raised by strangers. And sure, I learned a lot, but I kind of wish I would have been with my family. And so she gets in the capsule with her daughter, and they go and fly out into space for this other planet that has human-like beings. And I think that's actually pretty interesting as well. So I would love to see more of that story. Overall, this was really interesting. I quite enjoyed DC's Nuclear Winter Special. I think overall the stories were really strong. Some obviously stronger than others, and you know, you may take different things out of each story. I know the Aquaman story was a little odd, but for me the Dexter Soy art really sold it. Basically, it does take place in the post-apocalypse, and this group of humans goes to find Aquaman to find this like microorganism in the ocean that supposedly can save humanity. And so he goes down there and fights like two-headed sharks and like shark crab creatures and stuff, and then finds this cave. And in the cave, there's like normal looking sharks and fish. And he's like, huh, maybe this stuff can really help save us. And so he grabs some of it and puts it in a little cup, and that's where the story ends. And also people, I heard people complaining about how the story ended. I thought it was actually really quite well done. Because you don't need to continue that story, right? You don't need to see if this thing will save the world. You can assume it will based on what you saw in like a very short story, right? It's like 3 pages long. So that one I enjoyed quite a bit as well. Anyways, DC's Nuclear Winter Special number 1. Is there a number? I don't think there's a number. It's just a special. Really, really good. 4 out of 5 as well on that one. The final book I want to talk about is the other one that's a little divisive, and that is Heroes in Crisis number 3. And I haven't talked about Heroes in Crisis at all in this podcast because I thought I wanted to wait until the final one came out. I think it's a 9-issue mini-series. Is this still a mini-series? Maybe a maxi-series. 9-issue series. Of course, Tom King writing. We have Clayman, supposedly an art, but he only did 2 pages in this book, the first page and the last page. Lee Weeks did the fill-in art, so hello, Lee Weeks is freaking brilliant. Just let Lee Weeks do the whole thing. Sorry, Clayman, but Lee Weeks can put this out on time. We have colors by Timo Marie, letters by Clayton Cowles, cover by Clayman and Marie, and then we have a variant cover by Ryan Sook, which is the one that I got. So there were some things that happened at the end of issue 2, and I'm not going to talk about those here because they're kind of irrelevant to this issue. I know some of the folks talking about this book were kind of upset that some of the stuff that was brought up in issue 2 was not resolved in this one. But I got to tell you, you're obviously not reading this book correctly, and you obviously don't understand how Tom King writes his books. Now, I have been very critical of Tom King's work on Batman, for example. I am really enjoying Heroes in Crisis. I have enjoyed all 3 issues. I think all 3 issues have actually been really brilliant. So it's not a matter of Tom King. It's just a matter of the book that's being worked on. And I think this one is actually really, really quite interesting. Now, the use of the NaN panel grid can be a little jarring sometimes, I think. But Tom does a really good job with the NaN panel grid. And really knows when to use it to its full advantage. So in this particular book, it's really done when a character is being interviewed at Sanctuary. I also like the way that it was used in the last page to kind of let us know some of the folks that were killed at Sanctuary. So spoiler alert, if you haven't read it, I'm going to read these. It is Commander Steel, Gunfire, Tattooed Man, Narc, Red Devil, Protector, Poison Ivy, Solstice, and Nemesis. And of course we saw Roy Harper and Wally West and stuff in the previous issues, among others. Also Lagoon Boy, which I think was already revealed. That was one of the ones we saw in the first one. And Lagoon Boy is an interesting one because he is, I would say, the central character of this 3rd issue. Which is very odd, of course, because I guarantee you, you are thinking to yourself, who the hell is Lagoon Boy? And I got to tell you, you are not necessarily incorrect, because I was not fully aware of Lagoon Boy, and I really didn't know why it was such a key aspect of this issue until I started thinking a little bit about it. And I got to say, it actually made perfect sense, because the characters that take center stage in this book, Lagoon Boy, Flash, Wally West Flash, and Booster Gold, really kind of help establish what the Sanctuary is to make us understand a little bit better how it works. I mean, the whole time we've known it was something that's set up by the Trinity, right? Batman, Superman, Wonder Woman. And they're using, as we learn here, Kryptonian crystals to generate this kind of like virtual reality matrix type world where heroes can undergo therapy for their issues. And how they undergo this therapy is actually completely up to them, which I thought was actually interesting. And maybe part of the reason why there's somebody that has killed all these people in this world. Now, I'm still not convinced that has actually entirely happened, but we'll get to that later. Now, the Lagoon Boy story is interesting, right? Because he was killed. Excuse me, he wasn't killed. He was put in a coma by the children of Trigon in Titans. And he is kind of in Sanctuary to work through that. And part of the way he's working through it is he is basically going into the woods and getting shot, presumably by a laser. I mean, it could be some kind of being shooting an energy blast at him. Getting shot and killed repeatedly, or at least knocked out unconscious repeatedly. And he has been doing this for hundreds of times since he's been at Sanctuary. And I think that's actually a rather interesting way of working through your problems. But he actually does, halfway through this book, come to a resolution as to how he can resolve his problem. And he kind of stops the simulation halfway, where the laser just stops in midair. And he's like, we'll resume this tomorrow. And I found that whole thing really interesting, right? How he's dealing with this personal mental crisis, dealing with the fact that he was nearly killed, that he was in a coma, and how he finds the balance within himself to learn to overcome that. Of course, it happens at the wrong time, because this flashback sequence happens before the events of the first issue, and of course we know that Lagoon Boy gets killed in the first issue of the series. But I thought that whole thing was really interesting. We see something similar with Flash, Wally West Flash, and what I found really interesting about that is that this is really a callback to the stuff that we were seeing in DC Rebirth, and the original Arc of Titans that was very much coming out of that Rebirth story, and something that we really haven't seen. I mean, I've talked about it on this podcast before. Why is Wally not being made more prominent? Why is the whole Rebirth storyline kind of being put to the wayside? And the fact that Wally's dealing with some of those aspects in this issue, I thought was really interesting, because it does have me thinking, why is this actually happening? And of course, I'm not going to talk about why, but we all know that Dan Didio hates sidekicks, right? That's why he wants to kill Wally West. That's why he wants to get rid of Nightwing, right? Now we have Dick, or what is his name? Rick Grayson. He hates sidekicks. He hates repeat characters, right? Characters that are based on other characters and that are very similar. So that seems to be the reason why all this is happening. And there's this whole thing that I saw on Twitter going on about this. There's websites writing articles about this. I haven't read any of those, partially because, number one, I don't care what they have to say about it. And number two, I don't think it's really a secret that Didio doesn't like these characters. I mean, it's been this way for a long time, since New 52. And we all know how well New 52 worked out. I mean, I know some of us enjoyed some of the books, some of us enjoyed a lot of the books, but overall, in terms of the comic reading audience, that was not very successful. And the fact that we're starting to see some hints of this coming back does not bode well for me, but whatever. We have Heroes in Crisis, and that's a great book, and that's what we're talking about. So we're going to continue with that. Wally's thing is he doesn't want to be alone. Right, he wants his family, right? I mean, he doesn't have Linda. He doesn't have his kids, Jay and Iris. And that's what his therapy is, right? In his world that he's building at Sanctuary, he is with his kids fighting crime. And he sees Linda, and he gets to hug his kids and love them. And he says, hey, you know, Jay, I love you. Jay, Iris, I love you. And they say, I love you too, Daddy. And it seems a little weird, but because of the atmosphere the mood of this book, I think it works very well that that would happen. Plus, of course, we know it's not a real thing that's going on, right? It's all kind of in his head. And he kind of reemphasizes some of that when he, after the alarm sounds and he goes to see what's going on and finds Roy Harper dead, where he reiterates to Roy, hey, like that, the reason I'm here is because I'm alone and I'm creating these things with my kids because I'm alone, but being here makes me not alone. And now you're dead. I thought that was fascinating, right? Because it's something we don't normally see in characters. Again, this kind of goes to the Dan Didio thing. Dan doesn't want heroes to be happy, right? He doesn't want them married. He doesn't want them having good family lives. He wants them to just always be depressed and fighting crime. And some of that works for some folks better than others. But then sometimes it just leads to kind of weird stories popping up. Like Batman being an emo crybaby. And look, like I was an emo kid growing up. So I'm not talking crap about emo. In fact, I still listen to a lot of the same music that I did back then. So it's not about that. But it doesn't always work that way, right? I mean, when we read comics, I think we read comics because we see certain aspects in these characters that we want to emulate, right? And we know these aren't real characters. So I would hope that we know that these are not real characters. Unless you're Grant Morrison, in which they are very real in that case. But we know that, right? But there's characteristics that we want to emulate. And sometimes we want characteristics in ourselves to be emulated in those characters. And as a result, I think we want our heroes to be human, right? We don't just want them to be super gods all the time. We want them to have human aspects. And I think that's exactly what Tom King is doing with this book. And as a result, I think it makes it better. And I would love to see, you know, like Superman and Lois and John be a family again. Because that worked really well. And now it's broken up. But some stuff I don't really care for, like Batman being happy. Like, I'm cool with Batman being Batman. Although I have seen stories where he is married to Selina and lived happily ever after before. And I think that story was beautiful. So it's not about that. So I don't understand. But I do like what Tom is doing here. The Booster one was actually one of the more interesting ones of the three. Because Booster creates a reality for himself in which he is basically in an interrogation room talking to himself, and his other self is extremely nasty to himself. God, that's a lot of that's weird, but he's very nasty to himself. He's like, oh, hey, what's wrong with your hair? Are you balding? Like, why are you such a jerk? Why would you create this reality in which you're talking to yourself in a crappy room? Why not be on a beach in Hawaii talking to a princess or whatever? I can't remember what the exact line was. But I think it's because Booster, number one, understands what it is that this place is about. And number two, wants to make it work. Because it's pretty obvious from this issue that Booster really hates himself. Right? And that's part of the reason why he has this extremely light comedic attitude towards everything. And that's something that's very real, right? Like, if you look at comedians, a lot of comedians are extremely depressed. You see comedians committing suicide, I think, more than maybe some other folks. Because of that, and the comedy is kind of a way for them to express those things, right, onto other people, to express their reality, and kind of work through their own problems. And that's kind of what Booster's doing here. So I thought that whole thing was really fantastically well done. Now, at the end of this issue, we kind of do see maybe who's killing folks, but I'm not convinced that that is who it is. I know folks have kind of talked about either Harley or Booster being the killers. We maybe get an answer to that here. Like I said, I don't think that's necessarily true. And why that's true, I don't want to talk about yet because this book is only three issues in. But I'm sure we'll get to learn quite a bit more on that. But I thought this was really fantastic. I know some folks don't like the slow pacing of the book, and you know that's fine. But I think this is something that is a completely different type of superhero book. And I think the way that this particular issue was done seems to be from my understanding of what Tom wanted to do. And again, I'm not friends with Tom. So, you know, I have friends that are friends with Tom. If they want to chime in and tell me, by all means. But it seems like this seems more like what Tom wanted to do originally with the storyline, as opposed to some of the other elements that have been brought in that I'm not necessarily convinced were part of the original pitch for the book. But overall, I really enjoyed it. This is a 5 out of 5 for me. I think it's an absolutely brilliant take on superhero comics, and I wish more writers, number one, had the skill, and number two, had the testicular fortitude to try to convey on a page. So really, really fantastic. I eagerly await the next issue. Again, Heroes in Crisis number 3 is a 5 out of 5. All right, tomorrow, New Comic Book Day. Let's talk about some of the books that I'm looking forward to picking up on a little segment I like to call the Comic Predictor. And first up, I've got from Black Mass Studios, Snap Flash Hustle number 1 is a 4-issue miniseries written by Pat Shand, whom I adore. I think he's fantastic. Emily Pearson on art. And this is kind of a weird story, but when I read the solicit, I was like, huh, this kind of rings like real life. So I'm going to read it first. Haley Mori, a downtrodden alternative model, happens upon a secret society of elite models in New York City that are using their platforms to sell narcotics. Seeing a possible escape from a lifetime of crushing debt, Haley becomes involved and works her way up the ranks, making new alliances and enemies like getting wasted of power she never knew she craved. In the stylish new crime thriller from Pat Sean and blah, 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 nothing is as it seems. Okay, so this reminds me of, I don't know if you guys have heard of this Nexium cult, but that's kind of what it reminds me of, right? And that was like actors and superstars involved in this cult that was kind of a weird drug sex cult. I never understood, like, what it is they believed or did, but it reminds me of that, so I look forward to it. I like what Black Mass does on a large scale, and I think they do tend to tell innovative and different type of stories. So looking forward to Snap Flash Hustle, number 1. From Dark Horse Comics, we have LaGuardia, number 1, Nnedi Okafor writing, and the artist is Tana Ford. Is that right? Yeah, that's right. Now, I am familiar with Nnedi from her fiction work. She's a novelist, and I look forward to checking this book out as well. I'm not very thrilled with the cover, by the way. If you get a chance to look at the cover, by all means do. But I am interested in the story, and I'm a little concerned it'll be a little on the nose once I read it. I'm hoping that's not the case, because Nnedi is a great novelist. But basically, this takes place in an alternate world where aliens have come to Earth, and basically one of the main immigration outposts is LaGuardia Airport in New York City. So this, of course, takes place in New York, much of it in the South Bronx and the projects, an area of which I'm very familiar because I grew up not too far from there. And it has to do with African immigrants and aliens and what that all means. And I think it could be really interesting if done properly. I'm trying to think, what was that TV show with the alien cops? Oh man, I wish I remembered. I want to say Alien World, but that's not it. Anyways, there was a TV show back in the day, and I know some of you are yelling at me over your earphones. There was a TV show where it dealt a lot with this kind of thing, right? Aliens came to Earth, and they tried to assimilate into human society. But of course, they still suffered a lot from prejudice by humans, even though they were just here to escape their terrible war-ridden home planet. And this seems like kind of what that story is going to be about as well here. And I very much look forward to it. Very much look forward to it. I do enjoy Nnedi's work, her novel work. That is LaGuardia from Dark Horse Comics. Over at Image, we have Die number 1, Kieran Gillen and Stephanie Hans. Now, I'm not a big fan of Wicked and Divine. I'll say that up front. I know some of you are gasping because it seems like everyone loves it. I don't. I've never cared for the book. But I do like Kieran Gillen's other stuff. And I find it weird that they would call this Die, because Image already has a book called Die, Die, Die. So is this like a third as good as Die, Die, Die? I'm not even reading Die, Die, Die anymore, so I don't know. But this could be interesting. Die is a pitch-black fantasy where a group of 40-something adults have to deal with a returning unearthly horror they barely survived as teenage role-players. Kieran describes this as goth Jumanji. So that has me curious, because I love Jumanji, even though the rock version. So we'll see. We'll see. I do like Stephanie's art, though, so that's really the main draw for me in this book. That is Die number 1 from Image Comics. Also from Image, we've got Freeze number 1. This is Dan Wicklin with Phil Sevian art. And this is a post-apocalyptic book. I believe it's an ongoing, not a miniseries. The entire population of the world has been frozen by a mysterious global event, except Ray, one person. And he's the only one with the ability to unfreeze him. Well, yeah, because he's the only one left. How is anybody else going to unfreeze themselves? And so this is going to kind of follow him as he basically gets to decide the fate of the world and whether people should be unfrozen. Thought out? I don't know. We'll see. This has a lot of promise for me, if done properly. And sometimes it's very difficult to do books with only one central character as the main character. So, of course, you need to end up introducing other folks. And so kind of the premise goes by the website, right? When you're the last man on Earth and there's like 10 other people that are also around you, you're not necessarily the last man, are you? Anyway, looking forward to this one. That's Freeze number 1 from Image Comics. Also from Image, Prodigy number 1, a series that I've been looking forward to for a while. This is a 6-issue mini from Mark Miller with art by Raphael Albuquerque. And this is part of the whole Netflix comics thing, of course, being put out by Image. I don't know, it looked interesting. It's like if Tony Stark was a spy instead of an armored superhero kind of thing. So looking forward to this one as well. There's going to be a lot of occult elements in here, international government conspiracies, all stuff that I really, really enjoy. So we'll see how that goes. The final pick I have is from Titan Comics. I believe this is part of the Hardcase Crime line, and that is Breakneck number 1. It's a 5-issue miniseries written by Dwayne Swarczynski with art by Simone Guglielmini. God, I hope I said that right, Simone. I apologize otherwise. I'm usually pretty good with names. And number 1, I really enjoy the Hardcase Crime line of books. So whenever a new one comes out, I always put it on my list of books to read. This is kind of a... it's being described as somewhere like a 24 or Homeland or Falling Down. All shows which I really enjoyed. I ended up dropping out of Homeland, but 24, like, I watched all the seasons. Even the latest not so good season, that was just one season. Anyways, Breakneck, Swarczynski, it's a thriller with spies, and there's terrorist attacks and crazy government plots and sleeper agents, and I just love it. I love Swarczynski. I love this line of comics. I'm just in. I don't care whatever they put out. That is going to wrap up this episode of Comic Talk Today. Thank you once again for listening. You can, of course, reach me on Twitter at Geekvine. You can email yell@comictalk.today. I will be back tomorrow with a very interesting topic. I'll be talking about the cancellation of Daredevil and why that makes me angry. I don't know. It doesn't really make me angry. But I'll catch you then.